All right, so get this. Picture yourself walking through Grant Park in Chicago, and you stumble upon this unbelievable wildflower meadow.
Not just any meadow, though.
No, not just any meadow. It's huge, like 2 football fields big. We're talking Wildflower Works here, a masterpiece of living art.
Created by the renowned artist Chapman Kelly.
Exactly. But hold on, because here's where things get interesting. Years later, the city decides to, well, they kind of mess with the garden, do you know?
Make some changes.
Yeah, changes. And Kelly,
He sues them, claiming it's a copyrighted artwork.
can you believe that? I mean, can you even copyright nature? It's wild. So that's what we're diving into today, the totally fascinating case of Kelly v. Chicago Park District. It's like art, law, and the very definition of authorship all kind of crash into each other.
It really is a fascinating case, and you know what makes it even more intriguing?
What's that?
Kelly didn't just go for the usual breach of contract claim. He argued that the city actually violated his moral rights as an artist.
Moral right.
Yeah, it's a concept that a lot of people aren't super familiar with.
I'm definitely one of those people.
So this case went all the way to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals,
Wow.
and it forced everyone to really grapple with this question. Can a garden, something that's designed to grow and change by its very nature, can something like that actually be protected by copyright?
That's like, I don't know, trying to catch lightning in a bottle or something.
It's a good analogy.
So, Avi, let's back up a bit. Back in 1984, Kelly creates this incredible installation of all these native wildflowers in Grant Park, right? Wildflower Works.
Right.
Then, fast forward to 2004, the city decides, hey, let's revamp this garden. They change the size, the shape, even the types of plants they're using.
Yeah, it was a pretty significant overhaul.
I could see why Kelly was upset.
Oh, he was. And so his lawsuit had two main parts. First, he claimed the city breached an implied contract, you know, by altering his creation. And
The
second,
moral rights thing?
exactly, he argued the city violated his moral rights under the Visual Artists' Rights Act of 1990, VARA, as it's usually called.
Vara, Vara. Okay, I've heard of it, but to be honest, I wouldn't know Vara if it hit me in the face.
Well, think of VARA as this shield that protects an artist's connection to their work, even after they don't own it anymore.
So even if they've sold it, they still have some say.
Exactly. It's about making sure their artistic vision, their legacy, stays intact.
Makes sense.
So it boils down to two main rights. First, there's the right of attribution.
Attribution, okay.
Basically, the artist has to be properly credited for their work. Like, imagine someone buys your painting and then they display it, but they never even mention your name.
Rude.
Right, that's the kind of thing VARA tries to prevent.
Okay, I can get behind that, giving credit where credit is due. What's the second right?
The second one is the right of integrity, which is all about preventing changes that could damage the artist's reputation. So, for example, if you bought a Banksy print, could you just like add your own graffiti to it and call it your own?
Well, no.
Right, VARA would probably step in and prevent that kind of alteration. But here's the thing, VARA only applies to works of visual art that are already copyrightable.
I see where you're going with this.
And that's where the whole garden debate gets, well, thorny.
So now the court has to decide if something like a garden, which is literally alive and changing all the time, could even be considered copyrightable in the first place.
Yep.
What a legal puzzle.
It is. And you know, the court's reasoning here is really interesting. They actually overturned the lower court's decision.
Really?
Yeah, and concluded that Kelly's garden actually did show enough artistic intention and minimal creativity to be considered original, enough to meet that originality standard for copyright.
So, point for Kelly. Originality check, but I have a feeling this isn't the end of the story. Is there a but coming?
You're good at this.
Well, I've listened to a few of these deep dives.
You're right, there is a but. So while the Seventh Circuit said, okay, the garden's original, they ultimately said it couldn't be copyrighted.
Why?
Because it failed the authorship and fixation requirements. Basically, they were saying gardens are planted, not authored.
Meaning.
Meaning they rely on, well, nature's unpredictability, not just the artist's vision. It's like nature's a co-creator in this whole thing.
That makes sense. A painting or a sculpture, those are static. But a garden is always in motion, always changing.
Exactly.
How can you say someone infringed on a work when it's supposed to evolve over time?
That's the challenge. And the judge actually used this really great phrase to describe it. He wrote that a garden's essence is its vitality, not fixedness.
Wow, I like that.
Right.
It really captures that tension between traditional copyright law and, well, something as dynamic as a garden.
It does.
Okay, so Vera protection is out the window because the garden couldn't be copyrighted. But what about that breach of contract claim Kelly made? Didn't he get like a dollar for that initially?
He did. The lower court initially awarded him a symbolic dollar in damages.
But then it said,
But then the Seventh Circuit overturned that too.
seriously, why even bother with a dollar?
Well, this is where the specifics of municipal law come in. Turns out, Only the full park district board, not just individual commissioners, had the authority to make official contracts for the city.
Oh, okay.
And there was never a formal written agreement that guaranteed Kelly, you know, perpetual rights to his garden or that prevented the city from making changes.
So even that small victory.
Gone.
This case is full of twists and turns. No Vera protection, no contract claim. Kelly really got the short end of the stick here.
It seems that way, yes. But, you know, the implications of this case, they go way beyond just gardens.
Oh, I bet.
This case really forces us to think about how the law deals with art that's so intertwined with nature, with the environment.
Hold on, let's dig into that more. This case has my head spinning. We'll be right back to unpack the bigger picture of Kelly v. Chicago Park District and what it all means for artists who work with, you know, site-specific and living art forms. We're back and diving deeper into this whole garden as art debate. And I gotta say, this case is really making me think about how this ruling could impact other kinds of art, too. It's not just about wildflowers anymore.
Right. We're talking about any art that's tied to a specific place or designed to change over time.
Exactly. So like large installations, murals that are exposed to the elements, even those incredible land art projects that use natural processes as part of the art itself.
You're thinking about artists like Christo and Jean-Claude.
Yeah, exactly. They're known for these massive environmental installations that are meant to interact with nature, you know, like wrapping entire coastlines or islands in fabric.
Huge projects.
And don't forget Agnes Denies.
Oh, yeah, her wheat field in Manhattan.
That's the one, transforming a landfill into a field of wheat. It's a powerful statement about our relationship with nature, right in the heart of the city. These artists, they really push the boundaries of what we think of as art.
They do, and the Seventh Circuit actually acknowledged this in their ruling.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they didn't completely rule out VO protection for all site-specific art.
Yeah.
But they did say that living, evolving works like Kelly's Garden, those are a real challenge for current copyright law.
I mean, it's like the law is trying to catch up with how art is changing, especially when you bring in environmental art or pieces that use digital technology. You know, things that can be updated all the time.
That's a really important point. Copyright is built around works that have, you know, clear boundaries. You can point to something and say, this is the original and this is a copy.
Right.
But what happens when the artwork is designed to be temporary or to change with the seasons?
Or even, like, decompose.
Exactly. How do you even define what a copy is when you're dealing with something like that?
Mind-blowing. So if an artist wants to create a living artwork, a site-specific installation, how do they protect their vision? I mean, is there anything they can do?
Well, that's where having a good lawyer and strong contracts comes in.
Okay.
When copyright protection might not be enough, a really well-written contract can spell out the artist's rights and, you know, the responsibilities of whoever's displaying or taking care of the work.
So it's like a prenup for their artwork, basically.
I like that. It's about setting those ground rules up front to prevent problems later on.
Exactly. But even with a contract, you can't predict everything, right? What if a storm damages part of the artwork? Or a plant dies and needs to be replaced? Would that be an unauthorized change?
Those are great questions. And honestly, there are no easy answers. That's where things get really complicated and why I think we're going to see more legal challenges like this.
Yeah, as artists push the boundaries of traditional art and start working with nature more and more.
Right. It's going to raise all sorts of new legal questions.
It feels like we might need a whole new legal framework or at least some serious updates to copyright law to really address these emerging art forms. What do you think?
That's a debate that's happening right now in legal and artistic circles. Some people say, yes, we need to change copyright law to better protect these new types of art. But others worry that expanding copyright too much could stifle creativity. You know, it could make it harder for artists to build on each other's work.
It's a tough balance, right? You want to protect artists, but also encourage new ideas.
And it's important to remember that the Seventh Circuit's decision in Kelly, that's not the final word on all this. Different courts have looked at similar cases and come up with different conclusions.
Really?
Yeah, like the First Circuit Court of Appeals actually ruled in favor of Vara protection for a sculptor. His work was tied to a specific landscape, but it wasn't living, it wasn't changing.
Interesting.
So it just goes to show the legal landscape is still very much in flux when it comes to these questions.
Not a one-size-fits-all situation then.
Nope. Each case has to be looked at individually and within the context of its specific jurisdiction. And as climate change and environmental issues become even more central to our culture, I think we're going to see more artists engaging with those themes.
I could see that.
And that means more works that blur the lines between nature and human creation. And that will almost certainly lead to more legal challenges. We're going to have to rethink what we even mean by art and how we protect it in the 21st century.
It's exciting and a little bit daunting to think about all the legal legal knots we might have to untangle.
You said it. Art and law, they rarely make things simple. But that's what makes it so interesting to discuss. We're covered a lot. Maybe we should take a breath before we move on to our final thoughts on this case and what it all means for the future of art.
All right, we're back, ready to wrap things up. So much to think about with this case, Kelly v. Chicago Park District. What really stands out for you, especially for artists working with these, I don't know, less traditional art forms?
Honestly, the big takeaway, and we've touched on this, but artists need to be really smart about their contracts.
That seems to be a theme.
It is. When copyright might not protect them, a really good contract is their best friend. They need to spell out their rights, what they can and can't do, everything.
Like that prenup analogy we talked about.
Exactly. Laying down the ground rules from the beginning to avoid fights later on.
It's like saying, this is my art, this is how it should exist, and these are the boundaries.
Exactly. Thinking ahead about potential problems, changes to the art, how to maintain it, the environment, and making sure everyone understands the artist's vision and how the work might change over time.
And this case also makes you think about art and activism, especially with climate change and the environment. It feels like the law is struggling to keep up.
That's a great point. Kelly v. Chicago Park District, this could be just the beginning. As we see more art about climate change and the environment.
Which we are.
Right. We're probably going to see a lot more legal battles about copyright, moral rights, even what art means in the first place.
It makes you wonder, will we need a whole new legal language to understand and protect these new kinds of art?
That's a fascinating question. We talked about how Kelly v. Chicago Park District shows how traditional copyright has its limits when it comes to art that's alive, that changes. What if, instead of trying to force these dynamic works into old categories, we rethink the idea of authorship entirely?
Like how?
What if there was a legal framework that recognized both the artist and the environment as creators?
Whoa.
A kind of co-authorship that reflects how collaborative these art forms really are.
I love that. It's like we need a whole new toolbox to deal with the art of the future. This makes me even more curious to see how this all plays out.
It's definitely an exciting time to be thinking about art and law. Artists are pushing boundaries, redefining what art can be. Who knows what legal questions they'll raise next?
I can't wait to find out. Well, that's a wrap for our deep dive into the world of art, law, and how we relate to nature. We hope you enjoyed exploring Kelly v. Chicago Park District with us. Until next time, stay curious.